KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I want Americans to know that I am no threat to anyone.
Mohsen Madawi was detained by ICE agents when he arrived for what he believed was his final interview to become a U.S. citizen. He tells NPR his story.
It's Monday, April 28th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline connects callers with trained counselors and can also offer more specialized help.
Funding for services for LGBTQ plus youth could be on the chopping block.
And what they get with that specialized services line is they get somebody who can understand where they're coming from.
Also, the conclave to elect the next leader of the Catholic Church is set.
And the biggest story of the NFL draft is about the 144th overall pick.
We are talking about Shedeur Sanders because he's that polarizing.
Those stories coming up right after today's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order aimed at identifying sanctuary cities. NPR's Joel Rose reports it's the administration's latest effort to target jurisdictions that limit cooperation with immigration authorities.
The White House says the executive order directs the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security to identify sanctuary jurisdictions where local law enforcement has declined to cooperate with the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. That could set the stage for more federal lawsuits against those cities, counties, and states. The Trump administration has also tried to withhold funding from those jurisdictions, but they have fought back in court. Last week, a federal judge blocked the administration's latest efforts to withhold funds, saying it was unlawfully trying to force local officials to cooperate. Sanctuary jurisdictions argue that collaborating with ICE would drain their resources and undermine trust between police and immigrant communities. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Canadians head to the polls today in their federal election, where much of the campaign has been shaped by President Donald Trump, who continues to repeat his desire to make Canada the 51st state. NPR's Kara Joaquim reports from a polling spot in Toronto.
Affordability remains the number one issue for Canadians in this federal election, but much of the race has been fought over the American president. New tariffs and threats to make Canada into the 51st state have ignited an explosion of Canadian national pride, and it's helped turn the race in favor of Prime Minister Mark Carney. Just a few months ago, Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives were ahead by more than 20 points. The surge in nationalism has also translated to historic voter engagement. Canadians turned out in record-breaking numbers during early voting over Easter weekend, and long lines at polling places like this one in downtown Toronto seem to indicate that engagement continues. Kira Joaquim, NPR News, Toronto.
The Kremlin now says it's declaring a 72-hour ceasefire in its war against Ukraine next week. Moscow saying the ceasefire will run from May 8th through May 10th. Kyiv has called for a longer and immediate truce in the fighting. The move comes as U.S. President Donald Trump's been growing increasingly frustrated with both Kyiv and Moscow as he looks to broker a peace deal. Spain and Portugal continue dealing with major power outages. Reporter Alexis Marshall in Seville describes where people are outside and making the best of it.
Some people are beginning to see power return, but many businesses and residents remain without electricity after many hours. Telecommunications networks have also been disrupted, as have airports and train stations. Authorities are still investigating the cause of the blackouts. But at a public plaza, residents are gathering much like any other night, with kids playing soccer and patrons drinking what's left of the cold beer. For NPR News, I'm Alexis Marshall in Seville.
Stocks shook off a midday slump to close mixed. The Dow down or down up, or Dow up 114 points today. This is NPR. Houthi rebels in Yemen say a U.S. attack killed 68 people and wounded dozens more in a crowded detention center. It was one of the deadliest strikes so far in 6 weeks of intensified U.S. airstrikes. NPR's Jana Raff reports from Amman.
A Houthi-controlled television network says the airstrike hit a detention center full of undocumented African migrants in Yemen's Saada governorate. Iran-backed Houthis who control northern Yemen have been attacking ships in the Red Sea. They say are affiliated with Israel since the war in Gaza began. The U.S. has not commented on the latest attack, but the U.S. military said recently it has launched more than 800 airstrikes against Yemeni targets since it escalated its bombing campaign 6 weeks ago. The television images showed bodies being carried out of the wreckage of a building known to hold migrants. Tens of thousands of Africans cross through Yemen every year trying to get to Saudi Arabia. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
Shareholders of jeans maker Levi Strauss have voted against a proposal that would have done away with diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at the company. That's according to a filing today. It comes at a time the Trump administration has been pushing to dismantle DEI in the federal government. At least some companies, including Walmart, Target, and Amazon, have rolled back their initiatives. Levi Strauss, in upholding DEI principles, joined some other companies like Costco that are refusing to change their policy. Crude oil futures prices moved lower today amid ongoing worries about the U.S. trade battle with China. Oil fell 97 cents a barrel to settle at $62.05 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The conclave to elect the next leader of the world's 1.4 billion Roman Catholics is set to begin in a little more than a week, next Wednesday. That is when eligible cardinals, so those under the age of 80, will sequester themselves in the Sistine Chapel for prayer and conversation and debate and balloting. Joining me from Rome to discuss the process of selecting a new pope is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hey there.
Hello.
Hi. So start with the who. What should we know about these cardinals who are going to be in the chapel and charged with choosing the next pope?
Well, the Vatican says there are currently 135 eligible electors, about 70 total countries represented there, according to the Vatican, more from the Americas, Africa, and Asia than ever before. In fact, Haiti, Rwanda, and Laos now have their first ever cardinals going into conclave.
And talk me through the work. How is this process actually going to unfold?
So on the morning of May 7th, the cardinal electors in Vatican City will gather in St. Peter's Basilica for a Mass. They'll then process into the Sistine Chapel singing the Litany of the Saints. Now, that's a litany people also heard if they listened to Francis' funeral on Saturday. Then there are prayers and oaths. The cardinals hear two sermons that day. They're sealed into the Sistine Chapel under those Michelangelo frescoes, and the secret balloting begins.
That sounds so lovely. I would like to be sealed into the Sistine Chapel beneath some Michelangelo frescoes. How long are they going to be there?
Well, voting goes on until somebody gets two-thirds majority vote. Now, it could go pretty quickly. The conclave that elected Francis lasted just over a day. But Mary Louise, the longest papal election process, which wasn't technically called a conclave yet then, lasted nearly 3 years. So long, some of the cardinals actually died, but that was in the 13th century. So lots of rules and procedures have been put into place since then, including locking the cardinals in the Sistine Chapel and that adjoining guest house to help speed things along. So realistically, we're looking at a couple of days.
A couple of days. Okay, and so again, the cardinals are cloistered. The ballots are entirely secret. We're not going to know what they're talking about, what they are considering as they vote. Are you, through your reporting, starting to see some themes emerging before this conclave begins?
I'd say there's this idea of unity or diversity. Unity, meaning essentially a conservative view that doesn't allow for a variety of voices on various issues. And then there's diversity, meaning the Catholic Church could bear and maybe even thrive with a variety of views on various topics. That's the more progressive understanding. Now, I don't think it's ever a good idea to predict who might win a papal election, but I will say there are some prominent cardinals that represent these ideas. For instance, Cardinal Peter Erdo from Hungary represents that unity camp. And then you have someone like Luis Antonio Tagle from the Philippines, who's charismatic and represents that diversity camp. And the whole conclave, Mary Louise, will be overseen by Italian Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the most senior elector who served as Pope Francis' Vatican Secretary of State. And I'd say he represents the moderates working to balance that unity and that diversity.
NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose tracking all of this from Rome. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
Many of us have seen the video of Mohsen Madawi handcuffed and flashing a peace sign as he was taken away from a Vermont immigration office by federal agents this month.
Madawi is a lawful permanent resident of the U.S., also an undergraduate student at Columbia University and co-founder of Columbia's Palestinian Student Union. He is one of several students detained and in danger of deportation, ostensibly over their choice to advocate for Palestinian rights in the midst of the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza.
Morning Edition's Layla Fadel sat down with Madawi inside a Vermont correctional facility for his first interview since being detained as part of a wider interview that will air tomorrow on Morning Edition. He tells Layla he knew he was taking a risk when he arrived for what he believed was his final interview to become a U.S. citizen.
When I get the appointment, the first thing was, okay, is this a trap or is it legit? And I realized directly that I am dealing with two extreme opposite poles. One is becoming a citizen with full rights, and the other one is being detained and having no rights. And I said to myself, I see the risk, I see the opportunity, and I want the American people to see this too.
See what?
To see this level of injustice, that I'm doing everything legally, that I have prepared and studied for the Constitution, basically to answer questions for the citizenship about the Constitution and about this country, that I went willingly and respected the law, went to the interview, did everything the way how it's supposed to be done, and still the way how the government is responding to me, not to deny my application, but to arrest me, to detain me, and to throw me into prison.
Is there anything that you want America to hear from you?
I want Americans to know that I am no threat to anyone, that I am my work and my energy that I am putting to advocate for peace and against war is a continuation of the same struggle that Martin Luther King had. It's for the Constitution to fill the promise that it holds for the citizens and for the people of this country.
NPR has reached out to the Department of Homeland Security for comment, but has not yet heard back. Madawi has been charged with no crime, but the government is invoking a rarely used immigration act to deem that his presence would have adverse U.S. foreign policy consequences.
You can hear a wider conversation between Layla Fadel and Mohsen Madawi on tomorrow's Morning Edition. His release hearing is scheduled for Wednesday as his case continues in federal court.
Normally, we wouldn't be airing stories about any one football player being drafted by an NFL team, especially not someone picked on the third day in the fifth round of the draft. But a quarterback from the University of Colorado named Shador Sanders was expected to go in the first or second round after a record-setting college career. Instead, on Saturday, he was picked 144th overall by the Cleveland Browns. And among the many people left speculating about this unexpected slide was his father, the NFL Hall of Fame quarterback Deion Sanders, who I will just note was also his coach at the University of Colorado. Tyler Dragon covers the NFL for USA Today, and he's here with me now to unpack all of this. Hey, Tyler.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I am doing well. So the dust has settled a bit, and I'm wondering, is it any clearer today why teams were more hesitant to pick Shador Sanders than expected?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, this is a very complex issue with a lot of layers to it. I personally had him as the second best quarterback in this year's draft class. But when you you know, examine him on the field, kind of his strengths and weaknesses. Yes, he's an accurate passer. He throws with precision. He was a good leader amongst his teammates, broke a lot of Colorado single season records. But his arm strength and mobility are considered two of his major weaknesses. And then there were several reports where he did not interview well. Now, I did not hear that among teams that I spoke to. They kind of spoke highly of Shador, but there were reports that came out that some of the interviews that he may have been seemed a little arrogant or not prepared. And that kind of trickles down from team to team.
I mean, we've talked about the on-the-field reasons as to why he fell so far, like his skills maybe not being quite where NFL teams would like them to be. But, I mean, it's hard to separate Shador Sanders from the specter of his very famous dad, with Deion Sanders being the closest thing that Shador had to an agent. How much of this do you think was about teams who were just not interested in dealing with his father?
Well, I think that played a role. I mean, let's face it. Deion, he's Pro Football Hall of Famer. He's one of the best athletes, definitely best cornerback all time in NFL history. But, yeah, he's very confident out there in the media. He has a lot of flash, generates a lot of notoriety. And sometimes that's a turnoff to coaches or owners particularly. So that played a role. And also, Deion's kind of his de facto agent. Shador does not have a traditional certified NFL agent. And that could be considered, you know, a turnoff to some teams.
I mean, look, I will take any opportunity to talk about football. But I have to ask, Tyler, would we be having this conversation if Shador Sanders was not the son of Deion Sanders and just a very good college quarterback that some teams have reservations about? I mean, no athlete's owed a high draft pick, right?
No. And that's kind of the reason why Shador may have been dropped to the fifth round, because really the entire NFL draft, all seven rounds, all 3 days, I mean, there were over 240 players picked. And we are talking about one player drafted in the fifth round over all the first round picks, over a Cam Ward, Travis Hunter. And we are talking about Shador Sanders because he's that polarizing, because he's Deion's son, and because everywhere the Sanders go, whether it's Deion or Shador, the limelight and the spotlight just follows them. And that turns off some teams, frankly.
Tyler Dragon covers the NFL for USA Today. Tyler, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This Wednesday marks 50 years since the day that communist forces seized the city of Saigon, bringing an end to the Vietnam War. That conflict defined a generation, and it continues to reverberate half a century later in countless ways for countless people. For one Seattle man, the search for closure led to the top of one of the highest mountains in Laos. NPR's John Ruich has the story.
Rick Holland was in third grade when his dad was deployed to the war in the fall of 1967.
I said goodbye to my dad on my 8th birthday.
Air Force Technical Sergeant Melvin Holland was sent halfway across the world to play a top-secret role in Operation Rolling Thunder.
The attacks slashed at North Vietnam with renewed fury.
It was a multi-year bombing campaign to try to stop the flow of troops and weapons from communist North Vietnam into the U.S. allied South and force the North Vietnamese leadership to negotiate an end to the war.
Raids against oil stores in Hanoi marked a fresh escalation.
Tiny Laos, next door, was ostensibly neutral. But that's where Melvin Holland was sent with other men, to man a secret radar station at the top of a steep karst mountain near the Laos-Vietnam border. The military called it Lima Site 85. It guided bombers to targets, day and night, in all weather. On the night of March 10th, 1968, it came under attack.
A sapper team, Vietnamese sapper team, scaled the wall, the cliff, spent overnight on the cliffs, and came up from the cliff site and started the attack.
By morning, Lima Site 85 was overrun.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Nong Khang Airport.
The closest airport to the mountain is Nong Khang, outside Sam Nua, a remote town in northeastern Laos. Some 57 years after the attack, I've come here with Rick Holland on his first trip to Laos and members of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA. DPAA is the arm of the Pentagon responsible for finding prisoners of war, POWs, and those missing in action, MIA. By their tally, there are more than 1,570 Americans still unaccounted for from the Vietnam War. That includes over 280 believed to be in Laos. Several are potentially near here. On the edge of town, in a dry rice field by a river, members of a DPAA team dig small excavation pits. Others sift dirt through screens. They're looking for the remains of a fighter pilot whose jet went down here in flames after a bombing run in the late 1960s.
The plane, we have a witness testimony that said it crashed into the river.
Ali Campo is the scientific recovery expert on site.
But we have archaeological evidence showing that the debris field actually extends all the way up into these rice paddy fields.
The remnants in the dirt are tiny.
And we go through it, and anything that is man-made, anything that looks weird, anything that could be possibly considered bone or a part of the incident will get put in evidence buckets.
It's painstaking work, even on flat land near town with a big team. Lima Site 85 on Pupati Mountain is a different ballgame. There were 19 men up top when the site was attacked. One man, Chief Master Sergeant Richard Etchberger, was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor in 2010 by President Obama for his role in the fight.
When it looked like the ledge would be overrun, he called for airstrikes within yards of his own position, shaking the mountain and clearing the way for a rescue. And in the morning light, an American helicopter came into view.
Etchberger helped other men onto the chopper, and then, as he was loading on, he was struck by gunfire and died. Seven of the 19 men made it off the mountain alive. Holland was not one of them. A few days later, on the other side of the world, Rick Holland's mom, Ann Holland, was hosting a Cub Scout meeting when the phone rang.
And gets a call, says, Mrs. Holland, something's happened up at the site. We're not sure exactly what. We're not sure the status of the men.
It would be 2 years before the military declared her husband and the others dead. Ann Holland wanted proof, though. She and later Rick have been pushing for information or confirmation of Melvin Holland's death for the better part of 6 decades. The main search area at Pupati is not at the top of the mountain. It's partway down the side, on a sloped ledge at the bottom of a 600-foot cliff. DPAA believes the men's bodies may have been thrown off the top after the battle. Getting to the site is an endeavor. When the weather's bad, it's a 2-hour drive from town, followed by a hike. On good days, the team takes helicopters to a landing zone nearby.
It's pretty complex terrain, so it takes us about another 30, 45 minutes to get from where we're landing to the actual investigation or excavation area.
Weston Iannone is an Army captain with DPAA. He was team leader at the site.
It's a series of rappels, ascents, and then like hand over hand.
All the team members are trained in mountaineering. LIDAR and terrain mapping have helped them zero in on places of interest, where rolling or falling things might come to a stop on the steep slope.
Today, in a literal sense, it was putting on gloves and kind of just scraping the surface.
So far, remains of 3 men have been identified. 8 remain unaccounted for. For Rick Holland, the goal of the trip was to simply reach the top of the mountain, where his dad was last seen. There's a trail that leads to the peak, more than a mile up in the Lao sky. The Lao government would not let me go with him, so I gave a recorder to a member of the DPAA team that accompanied him. At the peak, with silent hills unfolding around him, Holland phoned his 85-year-old mother to tell her he had made it. And he sat by the edge, draped in a black POW MIA flag.
Pati! I'm here!
He spoke to the spirit of the mountain.
I'm here to ask your forgiveness! Please, let the men come home! It's time!
Bringing them back, he says, is his life's mission.
Dad! I'm here! I want you home, Dad! We miss you. We want you back so bad.
Neither the mountain nor the man answered his call that day, but Rick Holland says he'll be back. John Ruich, NPR News, Samnua, Laos.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from Vietnam, where nearly 200,000 Vietnamese soldiers are still missing. Some of their families are now calling on the U.S. to help find them.
This is NPR News.
We have the first interview with any of the students who've been detained here in the U.S. and threatened with deportation, ostensibly over their pro-Palestinian advocacy. Mohsen Mahdawi thought he was going to be a citizen.
When I get the appointment, the first thing was, is this a trap or is it legit?
Now he's at a correctional facility. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, we hear from a man in England who just broke 3 Guinness World Records.
He says he's now the world's fastest puncher.
When I first set out on this world record, I had huge boxing fans tell me I couldn't do this. I had people laugh at me.
That story after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Democratic governor of Illinois is calling for mass protests against the Trump administration's controversial immigration policies that have so far led to 139,000 deportations since Trump's second term in office. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker also blasting his own party during a keynote speech in New Hampshire yesterday, saying Democrats have failed to mount a stronger opposition to those Republican lawmakers in control of Congress.
Democrats need to make it a priority to pass real, sensible immigration reform. We need to secure our border. We need to keep and attract hardworking, tax-paying, law-abiding people and give them a path to citizenship.
The Illinois governor says Democrats may need to fix their messaging, but their values are exactly where they should be. In Memphis, an early morning fire has destroyed a historic church with ties to the civil rights movement. Christopher Blank of member station WKNO has the story.
Claiborne Temple was a hub of the famed 1968 sanitation workers' strike. The iconic I Am a Man protest posters were printed in its basement. Officials haven't cited a cause for the pre-dawn blaze. The 19th century building was being renovated into a cultural center, its new stained glass windows honoring civil rights leaders, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was killed nearby. Memphis Mayor Paul Young called the destruction heartbreaking, but said that, quote, the spirit of Claiborne Temple cannot be burned away. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Blank in Memphis.
The conclave to elect the next pope will commence on May 7th. There are 135 cardinal electors eligible to vote in next week's conclave at the Vatican Sistine Chapel. Pope Francis was laid to rest over the weekend in Rome. This is NPR. China and the Philippines have unfurled competing flags on a tiny reef in the South China Sea. NPR's Emily Fang reports it's part of an escalating territorial spat between the two countries.
China shocked its neighbors over the weekend when it announced it had seized Sandy Cay, a small reef in the South China Sea just a few miles from the Philippines' biggest Coast Guard station. The Philippines countered by sending 6 of its officers to plant a Philippines flag on Sandy Cay the next day. China condemned the move as, quote, illegal, even though an international tribunal ruled in 2016 that much of the area being contested falls under the Philippines' control. Multiple Southeast Asian countries have overlapping claims in the sea, which is a critical area for international shipping lanes. China has been the most aggressive in trying to stake a claim, prompting confrontations with the Philippines. Emily Fang, NPR News.
A Navy fighter jet rolled off a U.S. aircraft carrier and into the Red Sea earlier today. Officials say one sailor suffered minor injuries. The USS Harry Truman is there to defend maritime shipping from Iran-backed Houthi rebels off the Yemeni coast. The Navy says the $60 million jet was being towed from the hangar bay when it rolled off the carrier deck. Crew members were able to jump out of the way before the jet and tow tractor rolled into the Red Sea. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Department of Government Efficiency has made it a priority to gain access to computer networks across the federal government. NPR has now learned that DOGE employees have obtained accounts on two sensitive networks used to transmit detailed information about nuclear weapons. Joining us now to discuss this revelation is NPR science and security correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Jeff, just start by telling us who at DOGE gained access to these networks.
Right. So according to two sources who do have approved access to the networks and aren't authorized to speak to the press, the DOGE employees in question are Adam Ramada and Luke Ferador. And they appear to be, have been given accounts on classified systems at the Department of Energy, which oversees the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile. Now, Ferador is a 23-year-old former SpaceX intern who's kind of a DOGE super user. He's had access to many computer systems across the government. Ramada is not as well known. He's reportedly a Miami-based venture capitalist who's invested in SpaceX, and we should say SpaceX is Elon Musk's company, and Elon Musk is running DOGE. But neither of these people appear to have much experience with either nuclear weapons or classified information. The sources we spoke to saw their names in a user directory, and my colleague Jenna McLaughlin spoke to a third person with knowledge of the situation who described any access as a, quote, toehold in the system.
Jeff, do we have any sense why these two were given access?
You know, we don't really. In a statement sent to NPR, the Department of Energy initially denied the entire story. But in a second statement sent hours later, they acknowledged that the two DOGE employees did, in fact, have accounts on these networks, but those accounts were, quote, never activated and have never been accessed. Now, DOE said these individuals were only working at the agency for a few days in February. But as I said, our sources saw the names in the classified network much more recently, over the past few weeks, in fact. And it's still not clear why these individuals had the accounts that they did. These are completely isolated computer systems. They're only accessible on a designated terminal inside a secure room, and those rooms are specially designed for classified work. It's not like, you know, somebody hit reply all to an email and
right,
boop, they got a classified network account.
I want to understand more about what's on these networks, Jeff, and why it's so important that they're being kept secure.
Yeah, these two networks are used to transmit really detailed information about nuclear weapons and nuclear materials. The first one is known as the National Nuclear Security Administration Enterprise Secure Network. It's used to send restricted data between nuclear weapons laboratories and production facilities around the country. The second network is run by the Department of Defense. It's called CIPRNet. It's used to communicate with the Department of Energy about nuclear weapons, and it's also used for a lot of other secret information and communication with other agencies and departments as well.
So, I mean, these accounts existed, but Energy Department spokespeople claim that they were not ever used. But I do have to wonder, Jeff, if DOGE was on these networks, what exactly could those staffers see?
Sources I spoke to, some of whom worked at DOE previously, told me that even if you have a security clearance, you can't see everything or even much of anything on these networks. The classified information is all need to know, and you really have to have a reason to get into the files. So there's no evidence that the two DOGE employees had access to restricted data on nuclear weapons. But again, you know, the Department of Energy says the DOGE team hasn't used these accounts. But even if that's true, just their very presence, the fact that these names were on the network, that seems newsworthy. And that's why Jenna and I reported the story.
And here's Jeff Brumfield. Thank you.
Thank you.
to Spain now, which, along with Portugal and parts of southern France, came to a standstill today. An electricity outage halted traffic lights, trains, flights, mobile phone networks, ATMs, you name it. Some 60 million people have been affected. Now, power is slowly coming back in many areas, but the cause of the disruption remains unclear. NPR's Miguel Macias is in Seville in Spain, one of the city's hardest hit. Hey, Miguel.
Hello, Mary Louise.
I gather you have power now, but you didn't for a number of hours today. Tell me what happened.
Yes, indeed. So let me start by saying that electricity is mostly reliable in Spain. And I say this mostly because there are neighborhoods in major cities where supply is very unreliable. These tend to be low-income neighborhoods. In Seville, in Madrid, they're well-known. But that's not what happened today. Today was completely unprecedented. I've certainly never experienced anything like this before. It all started just after midday local time. The moment was caught on a live broadcast of the Madrid Tennis Open. Tennis player Coco Gauff was speaking live to Sky News.
So maybe I just need to not get a lot of sleep.
Well, I think we've just lost a bit of sound there. We're not able to hear.
Parliament in Madrid was affected. Traffic lights stopped working, causing traffic chaos. Trains ground to a halt. People had to get off and walk. Net traffic was severely affected. This chaos was mirrored in parts of Portugal as well, including the capital, Lisbon, and parts of the south of France. Backup systems kept power going at the sites such as hospitals, nuclear plants, and prisons, though.
Wow, sounds like just chaos across the board. Tell me more about your day. What happened in your city there in Seville?
It's interesting because while I saw people in my neighborhood mostly reacting calmly, I've heard from friends and family about some tensions, especially on the road. When the power went out around lunchtime, I went out right away and saw people going out in the streets to check with their neighborhoods and make sure this was not just their home. Then friends on WhatsApp right away started saying that this was a national thing. Supermarkets closed their doors, traffic lights were not working. The national traffic authorities asked citizens to not travel unless it was strictly necessary. On the streets, locals could be seen gathering supplies from convenience stores, anything from candles, water, ice, food, battery radios. Sirens were blasting in the background. I was stopped several times because I was looking at my phone. People asking me if I had service. I had some service, and then it completely went out for a few hours.
Yeah, and so to the big question of why, we said we don't know the cause. Are the governments there in Spain and Portugal giving any indication of what they think happened?
So Portugal's prime minister said that, quote, there is no indication of a cyber attack. All the Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez says that they were not ruling out any theory. He spoke to the nation past 6 p.m. local time. I just know that I recorded this on my battery-powered little recorder in front of a battery radio.
Sobre las causas. Todavía no tenemos información concluyente sobre los motivos de este corte.
So he says they have no final information about the cause of this power outage. He also made a special point to ask citizens to get their information from, quote, official channels. At this hour, power has been mostly restored in the south of Spain where I am, thanks to supply coming from Morocco. It does seem like the worst of this episode is behind us.
Thank goodness for battery-powered little recorders. NPR's Miguel Macias there in Seville. Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. 1 month after a devastating earthquake rocked Myanmar, some victims' bodies still have not been found. So far, officials report about 3,800 deaths, but many people say they're still waiting for news of their missing loved ones. Reporter Dave Grunebaum reports on the pain for one father who lost his family and the challenges another family faces now, and a warning. His story contains graphic detail about those who died in the disaster.
The sounds of jackhammers as crews drill through thick slabs of concrete, one on top of another. This used to be the 12-story Sky Villa condominium complex in Mandalay, but now much of it is reduced to rubble after a 7.7 magnitude earthquake struck Myanmar on March 28th. Watching silently, about 200 meters away, is Saimyo Thun. He lived in the complex with his family. When the earthquake struck that afternoon, He was on his way to buy fruit for the kids. The ground started shaking, and his condominium complex collapsed, burying his wife, San Tip, and two daughters, six-year-old Nang Han Main and three-year-old Nang Wei San.
I went through the rubble with my bare hands, and I tried to look for my family. I couldn't find them since I was just using my hands to dig through it.
1 month later, the stench from decomposing bodies is so strong that recovery workers wore up to three layers of face masks. Even then, one of them vomited on the site. There's no official tally, but crews say there may still be more than 100 bodies buried underneath the rubble, including Simeo Tun's wife and daughters.
Since I haven't seen their bodies, I still cannot believe they're really gone. But I don't have any hope to find them alive. Now, I am just praying to find their dead bodies. Every day I come here and wait for their dead bodies to be found.
Mandalay is about 10 miles from the earthquake's epicenter. Many buildings, health clinics, as well as religious and historical sites were destroyed or badly damaged in Myanmar's second biggest city. At a makeshift camp, a group of volunteers drove a pickup truck stuffed with packages of instant noodles and energy drinks that they handed out. About 800 people stay here, including Tha Tha, a 29-year-old primary school teacher who's here with her parents and 76-year-old grandmother. Their home was badly damaged by the earthquake. Now they all sleep under a green tarp that covers about 7 by 12 feet of space. There's a wood plank a few feet off the ground for grandma to sleep on. The beds for the rest of the family are just plastic tarps and blankets on top of a dirt road.
We cannot guess how long we will be living like this. We dare not go back to our house. We cannot sleep well. We have to continue to live on the streets.
Aid groups have expressed concerns about the risk of outbreak of diseases in makeshift camps like this where sanitation is poor. Tha Tha says they have mosquito nets and access to clean water, but they still worry about dengue fever, snake bites, and basic hygiene. Litter is scattered about. There are only a few toilets, and people defecate outside.
Living together with so many people in this condition, diseases are prone to happen.
Back at the site of the collapsed apartment complex, Simeo Tun sadly watches the recovery crews dig through the rubble. He longs for the happy times he used to share with his family, simple pleasures like singing a lullaby to his daughters each night.
My two daughters only go to bed if I tuck them in. Every night I sing to them at bedtime. Now I can't do that anymore.
For NPR News, I'm Dave Grunebaum.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Anyone calling 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, can be connected to a trained counselor. The line offers specialized help to some groups at higher risk of suicide, like veterans and those who identify as LGBTQ+. Now, a leaked document shows that the Trump administration plans to cut 988 funding specifically for services for LGBTQ+ youth. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has more.
When teens and young adults identifying as LGBTQ+ call 988, they are routed to a specialized service line.
And what they get with that specialized services line is they get somebody who cares, somebody who's been there with them, who has shared experiences, who can understand where they're coming from.
That's Hannah Wasilowski, Chief Advocacy Officer at the National Alliance for Mental Illness, or NAMI.
We know that LGBTQ+ youth are more than four times as likely to make a suicide attempt than their peers. And we know that crisis services geared towards LGBTQ+ youth and young adults works. You know, these services save lives.
Data from 988 shows that the number has responded to nearly 1.3 million calls and texts from such youth since its launch 3 years ago. Psychologist Ben Miller is an adjunct at Stanford School of Medicine.
Just this year alone, in January and February, it's about 100,000 contacts with the line. Those trends have been going up steadily since the line's launched.
Losing the service, Miller says, could be devastating for gay and trans youth.
Cutting this might mean that that person doesn't have a place to call or to go with someone that understands their unique needs.
The advocacy group Trevor Project is one of seven organizations funded by the federal government to provide the service for LGBTQ+ youth through 988. James Black is the CEO of the organization.
We are talking about potentially defunding suicide prevention, a suicide prevention program that has strong bipartisan support. And it is a result of legislation that President Trump himself signed into law during his term.
That was in 2020. And while the potential loss of LGBTQ+ services on 988 is concerning, Black stresses that the proposed defunding is in a leaked document.
This is only a draft. Nothing is finalized.
And any budget proposal from the White House would need to make its way through Congress. NPR contacted the Department of Health and Human Services to comment, but they suggested contacting the Office of Management and Budget, which did not respond. Should the specialized service on 988 go away, Black wants gay and trans youth to know that they can still reach out to Trevor Classic. That's the Trevor Project's own helpline.
We will ensure that they know that Trevor Classic is there 24/7, accessible and ready for them.
A recent poll by NAMI shows that 61% of respondents supported specialized mental health services through 988 for high-risk groups like LGBTQ+ youth. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
And if you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.
When Joshua Iyala punches someone in the ring, they probably won't see it coming. Iyala is a trained martial artist and content creator, and according to Guinness, he broke 3 world records last week. The most punches in 1 minute with gloves, without gloves, and with dumbbells. We called him up in England, where he lives, to talk about his record-breaking punches. Joshua, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, I just have to say congratulations. I just got finished watching the video of you hitting that punching bag over and over again, and it literally looks like your fists are flying.
Appreciate it. I just want to say that was probably the coolest intro I've ever heard of just anything. Like, yeah, you guys just hyped me up, so appreciate that, Wano.
I mean, this is such an incredible feat. You're doing these full extension punches, and that's when you throw a punch straight out, right?
Yeah. So a full extension punch is when your hand goes to your chin, and it fully extends, so there's only a slight bend in your elbow, and that's because you don't want to lock your arm out and, like, do some damage to your body.
So you broke 3 world records last week. What was the biggest challenge to get there?
Ooh, you know what? It was the mental training for me. So when I heard I'd have to throw over 450 punches in a minute, I was like, that sounds absolutely ridiculous. But it's just breaking down those mental barriers and realizing that your body is so much more capable than you realize.
I mean, what are you thinking about? What's going through your mind as you're throwing these punches over and over and over again? Are you counting, or is there some kind of mantra that you say to yourself?
So when I'm in that minute, it's completely just zoned in. I'm not thinking about anything apart from You better keep those punches up, boy, otherwise you're not getting those records. Like, you have to punch fast. So I'm just trying to think of anything but the time so it goes by as quick as possible.
Now, I've read that you used ChatGPT to come up with a training plan. Tell us about that, and how long did you train to get to this point?
Oof. So ChatGPT is probably my best friend. I speak to ChatGPT more than I speak to my friends at this point. I'm a big advocate of using AI and using all the resources which you have. So I'm actually a mathematics graduate, and I'm big into my analytics and stuff like that. So my uncle's a boxing coach, and I spoke with him. I've got some of his training programs, and I literally just gave the AI some of the data about me, about how I train, about my current stats, my weight, my current speed, and then we worked together, and we came up with a plan which clearly worked.
I know you've been doing martial arts since you were a kid. What made you decide to go for this record now?
I actually saw this record years ago. It was at the start of my social media journey, 2019. One of my other friends currently held it. His name's Pavel Kickboxing. And at the time, I was like, that guy's incredible. And I'm just not that guy. You know, I'm not as fast as him. I'm not as good as him. And when I started this training, it was tough because I was consistently training every day. And I think I could only throw just over 300 punches in a minute. And no one knows this, but I actually failed my first attempt.
Wow.
And it really lit a different fire in me because I'd worked so hard. I had my friends come and watch. And after that, I said to myself, this can never, ever happen again. So I got to work. I started training twice a day. I started doing mental visualization training. Everything changed because I was not going to fail again. And this time, I actually went to do it in person at the Guinness World Records office. And rather than doing just one record, I went for 3 world records, and thank God that I smashed all 3.
Wow. I mean, you've smashed these 3 records. What's next for you? Any other big goals?
So my whole purpose on my social media is I'm a big advocate of anything you set your mind to, you can get done. So I really don't know. As of right now, I am actually potentially considering the Olympics just to prove this point even further. I mean, I've just become the world's fastest puncher in terms of those Guinness World Records, but I'm a big advocate, you are limitless. So if I wanted to go to Olympics, I'll set my mind and train for whatever sport I want to do that in. But as of right now, I don't know. I really don't know.
What would you say to other aspiring boxers or punchers out there who might be watching your videos and seeing what you've just accomplished?
I would say there's too much negativity in this world, and so many people will tell you what you can and can't do. You are limitless. There's too many people that impose their limitations on you. Anyone out there that's pursuing any sort of goal, if you can conceive it, it's definitely possible. So don't let anyone else stop you.
We've been speaking with Joshua Yala. Congratulations and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of...